I'm very pleased to introduce two top Atlas Society intellectuals, Professor Richard Salzman and Robert Trzezinski, discussing what made Britain great and then not so great. This is an expanded format scheduled to go 90 minutes so we can do a deeper dive with them and the audience. Please share the room. Please raise your hand if you have a question for the scholars. Gentlemen, I'll let you to format this with some opening comments, and then we'll invite some audience participation.
Great. I thought I would just give a quick introduction. Rob and I have talked about this. I know Rob is learned on this, and I've long had a fascination with Britain, obviously going back to the American Revolution. But this was this discussion, this topic, the way we framed it, in some way was triggered by the death of Elizabeth. You know, not a bad time to say, draw a line, assess, go through the history of this amazing country. The idea that Great Britain became great, and then, as we would put it, not so great, and is worth exploring, maybe as parallels to America. There's a lot of common correlation between the rise and fall of various parties, Republican tracking the Tories and Labor tracking the Democrats. We can talk about that, but I thought what we would do is, and Rob will start, but we'll both discuss each segment. The first segment is basically what made it great. So starting, you know, suppose with the Magna Carta and all the things leading up, say, to the period when Britain started moving towards socialism, and I'll pick it up from there. But I think in total, we don't want to spend more than, I don't know, what would you say, Rob? We got 90 minutes, but I'm not sure we should go 60 minutes on this. What, maybe 40? No,
I'm going to do like a, how about I do try for like a 15-minute overview of my part of the history? I mean, I've only got like 700, 800, 900 years to cover, so it shouldn't take.
Yeah, yeah, that's nothing. So you should be able to do that very well. Yeah, and we can come in and out of each other's segment. That'd be great. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, so pipe up if you have something to add. But my fascination with Britain really is, you know, you said it going back to the American Revolution. Well, before the American Revolution is the stuff that I find really fascinating, because there's a reason why it was British America that ended up having that revolution and creating the system that we did. The British part of that, I mean, that's what they, Jefferson, the thing that Jefferson, there's a pamphlet that Thomas Jefferson wrote that basically got him the job writing the Declaration of Independence. And it was called like a summary view of the rights of British America.
Right.
So British America.
Yeah.
It's a great pamphlet to read, by the way. You should check it out. And it's very relevant to what I'm about to say, because he draws on the history I'm about to talk about. But it's very telling that, you know, they thought of themselves as, we are British America. And they were coming out of that British tradition, and they saw themselves, they were making a revolution, but it was the world's most conservative revolution, because they saw themselves as, we're just, you know, trying to defend the existing system that we thought we had. Now, they ended up going beyond that. You know, it was not purely conservative act, because they ended up, you know, as the revolution went on and as the conflict with Britain went on, they became more philosophical, and they eventually did a whole bunch of things once they created their own governments that were reforming even the old existing system, and moving beyond what had been done before. But they came out of this British tradition that was very special, that had created a foundation and a culture and a whole history that was conducive to the creation of a very vibrant, dynamic, free society. So I want to go over what that is. Now, so what I'm going to go over is sort of what's called Whig history.
Yeah.
The W-H-I-G. The Whigs were the sort of pro, in 18th and 19th century Britain, they were the sort of the pro-freedom party. And so this is the Whig version of British history, but I think it had certain obvious sort of suited the goals, political goals of the Whigs to this view of history. But I think it also has a lot of truth to it. And the way I put it is that the key thing about English history or British history is they're conquered by William the Conqueror in 1066, and then not conquered by anybody else after that. And so what happens is that the Norman conquest in 1066 creates a certain conflict or clash within British society and British culture and British politics. And I'm going to describe what that clash is in a moment. But it creates this clash or this conflict. And then because they're not invaded again for another, you know, 900 or almost 1,000 years now, because they're not invaded again, that conflict is basically allowed to work its way out in this internal struggle within Britain. And it's allowed to work its way out in a way that creates basically the foundations for modern free societies. So I want to talk about what that conflict is that was introduced. So I'm going to go back, you know, not just the Magna Carta, but before the Magna Carta. So Britain, after the Roman Empire collapses and the Roman troops leave Britain, Britain is conquered by the Angles and the Saxons and the Danes, basically these various Germanic or Viking or Viking-related groups of people. And they all bring with them a certain approach to government and a certain approach to leadership. And in fact, you know, it's reflected in the fact, I think, according to my research, the oldest continuously existing parliament in the world is the Icelandic Althing, which has been going for like 1,000 years, right? So they had sort of a proto-parliamentary system, and it came from the fact that in the sort of the general Viking Germanic system that was brought over by the Angles and Saxons and Jutes and all those people, it was the sense that every free man is essentially an equal, that he is an equal and independent actor. Now, they had slavery and all that sort of thing, so that's why I said every free man. It's not a perfect society, but every free man was considered an equal and independent person, and leaders and the political leaders that they chose were largely people who were sort of chosen to some extent or given, you know, freely given their allegiance by the people beneath them. And they were considered people who did not, you know, have an automatic claim on the wealth and lives and property of their subjects, but had to, you know, have a contractual relationship with them, a contractual approach to leadership, that, you know, the king was sort of accepted by his subjects, or not very sorry, the king was accepted by the people he led, but as, you know, by the sort of consent of, well, okay, we think you're the best leader, and we'll give you certain things and certain support, but we expect certain things in return, right? So it's this mutual relationship. Now, what happened is there's another group of Vikings who go down and they attack Paris and they try to set, and they attack France, and as to appease them, they are given a big chunk of northern France. Those are the Normans. So the Normans are Vikings who go down, settle down in France, get this big chunk of northern France, and they go native. They absorb essentially what was the French system of government, which is the feudal system. Now, I'm going to describe briefly the implication of that, because in the feudal system, basically nobody owns their land or their lives or their property free and clear. All property is owned by the king, and you can only own your property, enjoy your property as a tenant, basically you rent it from the king. Now, it's not a totally arbitrary system of government, because there are there are laws and there are customs that dictate, you know, what can the king claim from you, what do you owe back to the king. But essentially, the king is the legal owner of everything. You're just a tenant. You serve at his pleasure. And in order to maintain your property, you owe him allegiance. You owe him a certain number of men. He can make claims to you to provide soldiers and materials for war. You may owe money to the king. So, and it's the system, in the feudal system, it goes all the way up through society, from the lowest levels to the upper levels, that everybody owes something to the person above them, as their sort of feudal, as the sort of tax you have to pay to whoever's the next level above you in the hierarchy, and that person owes something to the next person above them in the hierarchy. A good way to understand it is a word, so everybody knows the word feud, or most people know the word feudal, but they don't know what it's contrasted to. So there's another approach to property that's called allodial. So allodial property is this idea that you own your property free and clear, that you have no debt to anybody, you are the sovereign owner of your property, and you don't owe anything to anybody higher up in the hierarchy. So that's the contrast. It is that under the Anglo-Saxon system, that you had before the Norman Conquest, the rule was allodial property. You're an equal and independent individual. You own your property free and clear. A political leader has to get your permission to get your leadership, your allegiance and your support and to get any money or what have you from you. And then the Normans come in and they've got the feudal system, which is the opposite system. So you see that, you know, and there are these, all these great old movies they made in the 50s, mostly based on Sir Walter Scott novels, where you have the Normans versus the Saxons and this big conflict between the sort of the conquerors, the arrogant Norman conquerors who come in and boss everybody around, and the Saxon, the oppressed Saxons who are trying to reclaim their rights. But this is basically the thing that works its way out through like 700 years of subsequent English history, is this question of what are the king's rights? What rights does the king have over the subjects? What right do the people under his rule have against him? And the first step, of course, in that is the Magna Carta, that as the king, you know, this is a couple generations after the Norman Conquest, the king becomes somewhat weaker. He tries to exert his power against the nobles, and they say, well, wait a minute, you know, we're going to rebel unless we have a charter that indicates, you know, down in writing what the system is, what rights we have and what do we owe to you. And it's the first thing that is put down as something in writing saying we have certain rights. Now, it was playing only the nobles at that point, only the barons and the aristocrats. But it's this first step of saying we have something down in writing that says in law, that says once and for all what rights we have against the king, and that there are certain limits to what he can do. And that sets up this, you know, the centuries of conflict where they're basically asserting that, and where those rights that are created by the Magna Carta then sort of spread out from being the rights of the nobles to being the rights of every citizen. Now, a book I recommend on this, by the way, is a great book called, you may know this one, Richard, by, I think it's Richard Pipes, called Property and Freedom.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, so it's a great, basically, the guy's, it's really just like a sketch, an overview. He goes over a whole bunch. He goes over some great stuff on Russian history on this, which I think was very clarifying. But talking basically about how property rights and the ownership of property, the correlation it has historically with other rights and with other political rights and with political freedom in general, that when you have a society where property rights are widely distributed, we have a lot of, you know, small independent landowners, and where the wealth and the property and the manpower in that society is predominantly under the control of these small independent property owners, what you have is a system where the power of political leaders is always limited, that they always have to go back to the cold's kicking in here. They always have to keep going back to these scrappy independent guys and getting their permission to be able to do anything. And that's where you tend to have, you know, free political systems arise and prosper, because you have those conditions. And he names three societies that had those conditions. One was ancient Greece. The other was Rome during the Republic. And then the third one is England in basically the first millennium, the first half of the last millennium. And so the thing I'm going to skip forward to really is 1689. So this is the glorious revolution, the bloodless revolution, where they finally got rid of the House of Stuart and they replace it with the House of Hanover, which is the predecessor of, you know, the current House of Windsor, through several name changes. It's basically the same people, the descendants of the same people. And so what happened is, originally, when William Conqueror invades England, he claims huge amounts of England as his own personal property. And then that property is so vast and so huge, and the income he gets from rent and from being able to get rent off of the tenants who live on that property is so vast that he can basically fund all of his operations through his own money, through his own cash, because he owns this vast portion of England. But what happens is his successors, kind of, you know, as aristocrats and monarchs tend to do, they get into a bunch of unnecessary wars. They engage in lavish spending. They are exploited by various hangers-on in court, you know, for special favors. And they start selling off and basically diminishing the king's property. And they reach the point where they can't fund all the stuff they want to do off of the property that's owned directly by the crown. So they have to then start taxing people. And that's when they get into trouble, because you then, you know, you start to have this system where you have all these small independent landowners and these other lesser nobles, and you have to go to them and say, okay, I want to tax you to raise money to pay for this new war that I want to fight. Well, they say, well, no, we're not going to let you do that. Or if you want to tax us, and especially after the Magna Carta, they've got that in writing. If you want to tax us, you have to call us in for a parliament. You have to call us in and convene us as a legislature. And then we have to agree to this. So this is the old Viking allodial rule by permission system reasserting itself, right? You have to come in here, you have to ask us, and we have to agree to this. We have to give our consent to you taxing us. And so this creates this whole, like, centuries of conflict. I won't go into the detail, but centuries of conflict between king and parliament. And all of that is basically, you know, and at each stage of this, basically the parliament does is it says, okay, we'll agree to your latest tax, but you have to formally recognize some other right or privilege that we want to have recognized against the king. And so they claw back more and more rights and more independence. And eventually what happens when they get rid of the Stuart kings in 1689 is the new king coming over from I think it's from Saxony too.
I think it was from the Netherlands.
Yeah, it was Orange, but it was a similar area. So the new king coming over, what he agrees to is a system where he says, well, look, the expenses of the king, and these are basically the administrative, mostly this is referring to the administrative expenses, the money the king uses to run the army, the money the king uses to run all the ministers and all the bureaucracy that he has, all that money will be paid for by an allowance from Parliament. And they agree to how much that allowance is going to be. But that's the point at which the whole thing totally, you know, finally flips completely to sort of parliamentary supremacy, where the king is totally dependent on Parliament for the money that he uses to administer the government. And that's basically, you know, that's that the relationship is completely flipped to where the Parliament is, they're the free and independent people who are giving consent to the king. And not only giving consent to the king, but they pay his salary, so he has to answer to them. And that's really where the power flips. And it gets to the point where, you know, within 100 years or so, really by the time of somewhere in the reign of Victoria, you get to the point where the monarchy sort of becomes a figurehead, where it becomes ceremonial, but it doesn't hold the real power. The real power is held by Parliament, and which appoints the prime minister, who is the person who really runs things. But it's all the working out of this system where you go back to the old Viking system and of every individual as a free, equal, and independent person who then, you know, government has to, the leader of government has to go back to them for their permission. So it's this like 700 or 800 year long process of taming the power of the monarchy and making it dependent on the consent of the governed. And that's the theory that's developed behind that by John Locke. So that's why I think it's fascinating about how this is allowed to work out over this very long period of time. But it creates a system where you have that idea of the free and independent equal individual, and it creates this tremendous dynamism in the British society, this tremendous amount of independence and this tremendous amount of freedom, which I think is the root of Britain's greatness, is that it was able to unleash the creativity and the power and the ambition isn't quite the word I'm looking for, but the desire of its people to engage in commerce and grow and prosper. And so over a period of 800 years, basically the power of the states whittled back and the power of the individual in this system is increased. Now that's a very, very short, 30,000 foot overview of it. But that's, I think, is the deepest historical root of how Britain created this very vibrant free society.
That's great, Rob. I love all that. I endorse all that focus. Let me spend a few minutes reinforcing what you said, citing some other things, and then I'll go into what I think are the beginnings of the decline, the peak and decline of Britain, and then Rob will come in and supplement that as well, and then we'll turn it over to Q&A. Now, I think one of the main things you identified, Rob, and what is so fascinating, because democracy is the new religion, obviously, since the last 200 years, but this was a constitutional monarchy, and the whole parliamentary aspect of it. Yeah, we tend not to want monarchy. It sounds like autarky, but what the Brits achieved and created, which was so amazing, was constitutional limits on this monarch, and of course, in effect, creating a second branch, parliamentary, a legislative branch, and a check on the king. That was the Magna Carta was a big part of that, but also a judiciary wasn't quite separated in the way that Montesquieu wanted in France, but the U.S. adopted the three branch system. But still, Britain was known for rule of law. Britain was known for common law. Britain was known for Blackstone. Blackstone was a great British jurist who was cited by the framers and the founders almost more than any other Brit beyond Locke. Really amazing. Now, we forget Adam Smith was a Scotsman. Adam Smith was basically part of the empire. So the founder of political economy, the Wealth of Nations, 1776, Adam Smith. It's the home of the Industrial Revolution in the 1700s. It's the home of the gold standard of all people. Isaac Newton was a director of the mint, believe it or not, 1717, put the pound on the gold standard, the silver standard. That existed for 200 years. Amazing. Abolished slavery in the abolished slave trade, 1800s. Adopted free trade, 1800s. Just remarkable achievements. Now, today, of course, the British Empire is condemned for being a colonial power, an imperial power, a mercantilist power. Now, I stress to my students and elsewhere that colonialism, mercantilism, imperialism are pre-capitalist concepts. They're not really part of capitalism. Mercantilism itself, of course, is anti-free trade. It's a protectionist system. But nonetheless, I think we should be bold about saying the British Empire, all told, had an enormously positive influence on the rest of the world. So whether you go to Canada or New Zealand or South Africa or Egypt at one point, or Australia, the dominions that at one point, what did they say? The sun never set on the British Empire. And it brought civilization to heretofore barbaric regions of the world. And you could even argue that in the period of decolonization, India, for example, 1948, Egypt, even before that, you cannot, South Africa, mid-1980s, you don't necessarily see a good performance afterwards when the Brits leave. Look at Hong Kong, when the Brits leave. The rule of law deteriorates and erodes. So it's an enormously wonderful story. The Victorian era, particularly Victoria, basically reigning long time, 1837, I think, to 1901 or so. Not quite as long as the recent Elizabeth, but in a period where the queen and the monarchy were more important. I just wanted to name, in case of those of you interested in exploring further, there are really some amazing names from Britain in terms of the ideas that you should know about. So now, obviously, we've talked about John Locke, but another great one from the 1600s is Algernon Sidney. So just look for Algernon Sidney. He was great. I mentioned Adam Smith, but James Mill was also good. Now here's the problem. In the 1700s, the utilitarians started to take hold. I'm thinking of Jeremy Bentham, David Hume, Edmund Burke is a little better. He's not really a utilitarian. He's a conservative who opposed the excesses and brutality of the French Revolution. So he's kind of the origins of the Tory party and conservatives today. But he's an interesting thinker in late 1700s, especially regarding revolution. And but one of the, you know, some good things about Bentham, he totally eviscerated arguments against usury laws. So Bentham, you know, although a utilitarian, was central to defending finance, to charging interest on loans, which was like a leftover of the medieval period against lending money. Now, John Stuart Mill, interesting, mid-1800s, you know, known for On Liberty. On the other hand, over the course of his life, became a socialist. And this is kind of a mirror of what happened to Britain itself in the beginning of the decline of Britain. Because as you know, the utilitarians do not have, and specifically rejected, an argument for individual rights. I think Bentham famously said, the concept of natural rights or man's rights is nonsense on stilts. So the utilitarians, you know, their view is social, you get that today, social utility, whatever society wants, societal welfare, the individual is nothing as compared to the society. I mean, that is a British idea. It's a good borrowed from earlier periods, obviously, but I'm mentioning it here because a British idea in the mid-1800s, which would serve as kind of like the seed of the decline of its greatness. Now, the other thinkers, people I'd mention, again, if you want to study the greatness of Britain, even though it started shifting in the mid-1800s towards socialism, and I'll talk about that more, and causing its decline, there were some very kind of mixed but heroic defenders of liberalism in the good sense, in the sense of pro-liberty. And so here are some names, but they are mixed. But still, it's not as if there was a socialist wave and no one defending liberty. So this is a good lesson for American liberals, American advocates of liberty, when you're facing the statists. Herbert Spencer, who took evolution and applied it to societal life. Now, he was pro-capitalist, he was pro-individual rights, but he had a collectivist conception and was so enamored, actually he influenced Darwin as much as Darwin influenced him, but the whole idea of social Darwinism came to be seen as such a nasty and animalistic thing that Herbert Spencer's ideas were dismissed eventually by the socialists. But there is some good in Herbert Spencer, especially in Man versus the State. He had a case for individual rights and limited government, but it was mixed. Now, here's another one, the historian Thomas Babington Macaulay. Macaulay's excellent. He's got a history of England, which recounts and documents some of what Rob talked about, a lover of Britain who tried to explain why Britain was great. Another gargantuan figure, William Gladstone. Gladstone was not only an advocate of liberalism and liberty, he was a politician, well, I shouldn't say politician, statesman. He headed four different governments in Britain during the Victorian era. He was a finance minister. He was a prime minister. He was the most pro-liberty political leader, you know, engaged in day-to-day combat in British history. I don't think anyone in American politics has had such a long tenure as Gladstone did. So I am a big fan of Gladstone. Gladstone is amazing and a practitioner as well. So that's important. William Malick, M-A-L-L-O-C-K. Malick was the first one I could tell in the middle of the 19th century to say that the mind was the source of wealth. Incredible. Not only did he reject the labor theory of value, he has whole works on why ability, entrepreneurial, commercial, intellectual, engineering, ability is the source of wealth. And he was derisive and dismissive of the socialist arguments at the time, of course, that only manual labor created wealth. So the ability theory of production is William Malick. Really wonderful stuff. You can find his stuff for free on the internet because it's out of the public domain. It's in the public domain now. Here's another great one. Henry Maine, M-A-I-N-E. Maine wrote two great books, but his famous contribution was explaining how you go from a society of status to contract. Brilliant. brilliant stuff, very influential guy too. So the idea of status is, well, whatever you're born into, you know, whatever lineage or whatever race or whatever. And he said, no, the benefit of Britain and the greatness of the British Empire and the greatness of the civilized argument, the Lockean argument really is, no, it's now on the basis of consent. It's now on the basis of contract. And he was actually a critic of democracy. So his view was that we should be based on contract, including politics, but not unlimited democratic rule. So he was also warning against unlimited democratic rule. Another one, William Lecky, L-E-C-K-Y, 1865, A History of Rationalism in Europe. Now, to objectivists, rationalism is an error. It's the idea of weaving theories in your mind apart from the empirics. But Lecky actually means reason. He actually means rationality. So that is a fabulous history of not only Britain, but of Europe, where he recounts that the achievements of Britain and the Victorian era came out of a respect for reason, as opposed to faith and superstition. Finally, I would name a very good writer to look up, and you can get his stuff for free, Oberon Herbert, H-E-R-B-E-R-T, I think it's 1840 to roughly 1906 or so. These are people who, while Britain was shifting from liberty to socialism, were fighting the good fight. They failed ultimately, but they were fighting the good fight. Now, the turn downward. The main thing in Britain, which is so interesting, is as opposed to Marx's revolutionary socialism, they endorsed evolutionary socialism. I call this kind of like the socialism light, like the Brits were too civilized to be as brutal as the Germans and call for militancy and call for violence and call for grand larceny of expropriating the expropriators and seizing the means of production and killing the capitalists and the whole Marxist thing. The Brits didn't go for that. On the other hand, the Brits did go for socialism. And the main group is the Fabian socialists. So in roughly 1880s or so, Sidney Webb, George Bernard Shaw, the playwright, and others started advocating what was called Fabian socialism. And Fabian is actually, if you go back, is a Roman general whose military field tactics were retreat and delay and stretch out the enemy. So in other words, and he did win some battles, but the Fabians reached back and said, you know what? A frontal assault on capitalism, a seizure of the means of production ain't going to happen, or at least ain't going to happen in Britain. But we're still socialists. We still want government control of the means of production. But the way we're going to do this is through the vote. So ballots, not bullets. Evolution, not revolution. Not overnight, but over time. And we're going to convince not just labor unions and not just allegedly disgruntled proletariat. We're going to convince our enemies. We're going to take over the schools. So a part of their theory was take over by infiltration, by indirection, in effect, by sleight of hand, the institutions that were already respected. In other words, the Bank of England, Oxford, Cambridge, Parliament, any institution that had already obtained respectability because it was the great British Empire, they would infiltrate. And so their view was, we will become respectable inside the system. We're not going to overthrow the system. We're going to infiltrate it, infect it, and come out on top, and combined with democracy, meaning combined with an extension of the suffrage. That was a big thing to them. Get more and more people to vote, and then get more and more people to vote for socialism. So what's interesting about, and by the way, the major thinker here and writer is a German who influenced Britain, Edvard Bernstein, wrote a book called Evolutionary Socialism in, I don't know, 1901 or so. And the book was very influential, and the argument was basically, and his allies basically argued something like this. Marx was wrong. It is undeniable I don't know, 50 years after the Communist Manifesto, that the worker is not being impoverished, that the worker is not pissed off. We are tired, we Brits, we socialists, we are tired of waiting around for the Great Revolution. Now understand, this is prior to the Russian Revolution. This is prior to 1917. So these are disgruntled socialists. They're basically intellectuals and from Bloomsburg and elsewhere, who are waiting for the revolution and it hasn't come yet. So their view is, let's turn to trying to vote it into power. Now, when you think about it, this is actually possibly looking today, with the demise of the Soviet Union 30 years ago, the main model people are following today. It's called democratic socialism, or it's called social democracy. Now, in Britain, this was embodied. The Fabian socialists pushed a labor party. So prior to this, there were only the conservative in Britain now, the conservative parties or the Tories and the liberal party. That was Gladstone. So the liberal part, liberal in the sense of truly pro-liberty, classical liberalism. There was a liberty party in Britain. It started in 1859 or so. Interestingly, around the time of the Republican Party forming in the United States, it lasted until about the 1920s. And then it was taken over and the two parties became Labour and Tory. But Gladstone and the Liberals, were a great party. It's really sad. Really, the demise of that party is really sad. But the Labour Party in Britain, which still exists today, it is the major competitor to the conservative Tories. The Labour Party began roughly 1900 or so, but it didn't win an election till the 1920s, and it did dominate the 20s. And by the way, it's Section 4, or I think it's called Provision 4, Roman numeral 4, is nationalization of industry, public ownership of the means of production, a strictly Marxist goal, but by vote. And it was in that party's platform, believe it or not, until 1995. In 1959, when the Labour Party lost badly, Hugh Gaitskell tried to get the thing out of the platform and was defeated. So the Labour Party basically has been a socialist party for a long time in Britain. They've lost their power, but they were very powerful from the 1920s until Thatcher was elected in 1979. Now, did they actually succeed? Oh, before I say that, a couple of more names. Keynes, obviously John Maynard Keynes in economics, but also influenced politics a lot. His famous book was 1936, an alleged analysis and cure for the Great Depression, but actually it was Keynesian ideas. From opposition to the gold standard, to defense of protectionism, to a bunch of other things that contributed to policies that contributed to the Great Depression. Britain went off the gold standard to his great love in 1931. That triggered the U.S. going off the gold standard in 1933. But basically, it was World War I that turned the tide against capitalism and started instituting statism. And the British Fabian socialists were a big part of that. It's not that there weren't socialists in America. There were. But in Britain, it was really a force. And it was an unfortunate force. And to me, this was the beginning of the end of the greatness of Great Britain. Now, if you just look up nationalizations by country on Wikipedia, the longest entry is Britain. And it runs from roughly 1945 until Thatcher got in. They nationalized everything from the BBC to the Bank of England to steel to coal to rail to post to everything. They nationalized everything in Britain. A phrase developed, the British disease, or the sick man of Europe, or the origin of the brain drain. Did you ever hear the brain drain? Was doctors and engineers fleeing Britain in the 50s and 60s, because it was so oppressive, it was so disgusting, it was so labor intensive, if you will. And it declined every decade. And not that the conservatives didn't come into power sometimes, they did. But Ramsay MacDonald in the 20s, these are labor people. Clement Attlee in the 40s. They nationalized health. The NHS still exists, 1945. Harold Wilson in the 60s. James Callaghan after that. It was not until Margaret Thatcher came in 1979, and by the way, was a leading indicator that the U.S. would bring in Reagan, that turned things around. She privatized in the course of the following 10 years almost everything that had been nationalized in the prior 50 years. She brought the top marginal tax rate down from, now get this, 98% to 40%. Reagan brought the rate down from 70% to 28%. So the Thatcher-Reagan revolution, the UK-American revolution, well, I'm not sure I would call it a revolution, but certainly relative to the trend of the late 70s, really revived Britain and England, and to this day is reviled by statists. They call it neoliberalism. Neoliberalism means the new liberty, the new liberalism. That's really what Reagan and Thatcher were doing. They were trying to move those two great countries away from socialism back toward capitalism, not fully embracing capitalism. I think I'll leave it there. Rob, you may want to chime in on this trend. It is part utilitarian, the decline of Great Britain, partly utilitarianism, partly combined with socialism, obviously, with socialism, at least a 100-year assault on the great British capitalist economy from, 1880 to 1980, somewhat of a revival under Thatcher. I mean, the tax rate still is only 45 or so, but, they haven't obviously fully come back because they haven't fully come back to capitalism. But it is a story of, I think, the rise and fall of a great, great, great country. And any thoughts, additions, Rob?
Well, I've got a couple different things I'd like to. First of all, I think you're right that the fundamental thing, the thing that really knocked him off the rails, was utilitarianism. It was rejection. I mean, that utilitarianism was this rejection of the individual as the of the system, and it became the good of society is the center of the system. Everything flows from that. People don't realize one of the things that I've really grown to appreciate is that socialism did not start as an economic system. If you look at the Earth's origins in the early 19th century, it did not start as an economic system. In fact, the economics of it were very unclear. If you go to Henri de Saint-Simon, these guys in France, when they first started using the word socialism, what it meant as an economic system was very unclear. It really took Marx to come along for them to turn it into an economics. It was a social system. It was a moral system. It was specifically this idea that society, socialism, society takes precedence over the individual. And once that idea got in, that was the mind virus that basically wipes out. That wipes out individualism, it wipes out individual initiative, and it creates the socialist environment. I do want to say one. I discussed so much the sort of political roots of Britain's greatness. One thing I'm going to throw in that I skipped over is British empiricism. That is, now empiricism has its good points and its bad points, but there is very much, I mean, that when Enlightenment ideas sweep across Europe, the English Enlightenment is very different from other strains of Enlightenment. The French Enlightenment tends to be very rationalistic in this bad sense you were talking about. That, the French love constructing all these crazy theories, these castles in the air.
Yeah.
Somebody pointed out to me that everything you need to know about the French mind, you can go to Versailles.
Mm-hmm.
And everything's totally geometrical and all these little shapes, and that's very much the French mind.
Yeah.
Whereas, look at an English garden, right? An English garden is everything growing, looking as if it just grew there naturally.
Yeah.
And so the English mind had this reality orientation to it of everything's going to be based on observation. And now it veered, as in the Scottish Enlightenment, it veered towards skepticism and people like David Hume. But, the Lockean version of this was everything's going to be based on observation and this empirical observation of the world. And that is part of the reason why you get the Industrial Revolution in Britain, right? Because you have people who have been trained in terms of their method of thinking that, you know, science should be based in observation of reality and it should be oriented towards, you know, solving problems in the real world. And that's why you get the, you know, this huge number of great British engineers and inventors and industrial.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know when you want to open to questions, but I just have one more thing I'm going to throw in about colonialism.
Yeah.
So that, two good things to say about colonialism and two bad things to say about colonialism.
Okay, good.
So the two good things about colonialism, you know, in America, we should have mixed feelings, right? Because we were one of the colonies and when we decided we didn't want it. But so the two good things are, first of all, I think when people look at colonialism, the sort of modern version of colonialism is, oh, well, they were just racist and wanted to conquer people. Well, when you look at it, in colonialism actually sprang out of the age of exploration of all these different countries sending ships across the world and discovering right routes and opening up this enormous amount of trade with the East, primarily with India and China, but also all these other little islands out there that had, you know, various spices. And there was like one island where it was the only place that grew, that nutmeg grew.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's a Dutch colony that later became England. But so, you know, all these tremendous spices out, spices and silks and all these exotic products and this tremendously beneficial growth of trade between East and West. And then what happened is, so inside Europe, every time there's this sort of pattern over that thousands of years where every time a country starts to become wealthy and powerful, it decides it wants to conquer everybody else in Europe. Like, so the Spanish try it, and then the French try it, and then, you know, the last one is the Russians try it, right? And I think they're still working on that sometimes. Everybody, the Germans decide they've been left out and they try it, right? That's the 20th century. So the point is that each one of these European powers, when it gains power and wealth, it tries to rule everybody else in Europe. Well, I think the overseas colonialism, in my research, the overseas colonialism really grew out of that. Because what you had is this tremendous competition that, if the British, there's also, you know, they say that the British Empire was acquired in a fit of absence of mind. Because it's sort of like almost accidentally, you know, well, we suddenly rule all of India. How did that happen? Well, part of the reason it happened was the French would come in and start a trading colony in India. And then they'd try to say, well, we're going to exclude the British from trade. And so the British had to come and say, no, we're going to create a trading colony and we're going to push the French out. And that's really so a lot of the colonialism came from Britain trying to preserve these networks of trade and not keep them being in the hands of, you know, some country that's then going to use that wealth and power from the trade that it gets from overseas trade and use it to conquer all of Europe. Now, the second good thing about the empire is they really did bring the best ideas of Europe at the time. They brought them to all over the world. So, for example, the very first medical school, modern medical school in India, started in the late 19th century by the British.
Yeah.
They created all these educational institutions. They did it more in some places than others. And you studied Hong Kong. But Hong Kong is a great example where some of the most valiant people fighting for freedom in the last 20 years in Hong Kong. And it's because they had that British tradition. Now, Hong Kong is a good example, though, of showing here's the two things I don't like as much about the British Empire. So the justification for the British Empire was we are bringing civilization to the world. And it was, there's a lot to that. But when they brought civilization to the world, they said, we're going to bring civilization to them, but we're not going to let them have any control over themselves. You know, we're having civilized them, having brought them all these modern values. We're not going to let them actually act on that and run their own countries. And especially in India, you know, that we're going to educate them and bring all these British ideals here. But then, you know, we're going to have this cap where, you know, if you are a native of India, you cannot basically get into any positions of power. And that's the sort of contradiction of the British Empire is not, we're going to bring these great ideals to them and then let them establish their own free societies. It was, we're going to bring these great ideals to them and then basically leave them in perpetual status of children who are still learning. Yeah. And I think that really backfired in Hong Kong, because when Britain had not introduced to Hong Kong all the institutions of a free society before they left. And I think that's true with a lot of the other places where when the British Empire bugs out, they don't
have
an existing established culture of free society and a parliament and all of that.
Right. And Rob, when I have investigated this, when you look into the question of, hey, how come you guys didn't perform after you were liberated from Britain, other than America?
Yeah.
Their answer is, well, we were saddled with these years of British oppression, and it is total nonsense. Whatever good remains in India, the schools, the railroads, the medicine, left over from Britain. Yeah.
Well,
I just wanted to say briefly that before we go to questions, the issue of the welfare state also, sometimes Americans think we got the welfare state from Britain. We didn't. We basically got it from Bismarck. All bad things come from Germany, it turns out. Now Bismarck in the 1870s, 1880s, basically was the first quote-unquote cradle-to-grave welfare states. And the Brit Fabian socialists basically copied that. But if you want to look at the origins, really, of the modern British welfare state, which is just awful, just totally inhumane, it's the Beveridge Report. So there's a guy named William Beveridge, 1945, actually, I think a government official at the time, laid out the full case for a welfare state in Britain, and it was adopted. It was definitely adopted. Now, before we turn to Q&A, Rob, I got to give you a quote, guys, give you a quote from Keynes, 1933. Now, 1933 is the middle of the Great Depression. My contention is Keynesian policies actually contributed to it.
Oh, yeah.
And he is often pitched as a savior of capitalism. Quote, this is from something called National Self-Sufficiency, the Yale Review. Quote, the decadent international but individualistic capitalism in the hands of which we found ourselves after World War I is not a success. It's not intelligent. It's not beautiful. It's not just. It's not virtuous. And it doesn't deliver the goods. In short, we dislike it, and we're beginning to despise it. But when we wonder what to put in its place, we are extremely perplexed. Unquote. Yeah, I'll say.
Rob, yeah, well, one thing I want to throw in there is that when you talk about the underperformance of India for 45 years after independence,
yeah,
a lot of it is because they were too well colonized by England, and they brought in all the ideas of the Fabian socialists.
Well, right.
I mean, Nehru, Nehru, the leader.
Yes, yeah, yes, Nehru
in all these ideas in British universities.
Yep, they too nationalized things, and not until 1990 did they turn it around. By the way, Tony Blair, a kind of Bill Clinton light. Tony Blair in 1993, now this is the Labour Party head who became PM. Blair in 1993 said to the party, we need new Labour, not old Labour. What is new Labour? Get rid of that nationalization plank. And he fought them for 2 years. They literally, for 2 years, the Labour Party would not drop that nationalization plank. And to his great credit, Tony Blair got them to drop it. And once they dropped it, he was able to gain political ascendancy. So little hat tip to a guy who's not all that philosophical, but Tony Blair did turn the Labour Party off the socialist train. So let's take questions, Rob.
Good. Roger, thanks so much for being patient. I want to encourage everyone to share the room and raise your hand if you have questions. We'll bring you up.
Scott, I would love to hear from David. David just joined. David Kelly, the founder of Atlas Society, David Kelly.
That's right.
Let me know what you think, David.
Yeah, well, thank you, Richard and Rob. I wish I had you guys as a college teachers when I was an undergraduate, I would.
That's nice. Thank you.
I would have loved if this was an entire course, because there's a lot, you know, just what you provided is a huge amount of information. But I want to ask a particular question about the Enlightenment, and in particular, how you would relate the British ascendancy in intellectual science and development, from Newton to Locke to Adam Smith, which expanded our knowledge unbelievably. Yeah. Was there something in the, can you relate that to the history that Rob described, and Richard, you know, I'm interested in your take as well. The, you know, relating it to the feudal versus alluvial system of property rights, the individualism that was implicit in the Anglo-Saxon approach. Was there something that made Britain not only that led, first of all, to an intellectual foreground where they were the initiators of you know, scientific and other ideas on a scale, you know, way in advance of Europe. I understand Rob's point about that they were sort of temperamentally inclined to empiricism versus rationalism, which of course it is true, but why the, I'm gonna go a level deeper. Why was that? Can you relate that to the social circumstances at all? My question.
Yeah, I've got two things that are sort of theories on this. I haven't investigated enough to say this is definitely true, but I have two theories on this. One is, I think that the free and independent, the equality that was brought into the system, is it was not a strongly authority oriented and authority driven society, right? So when you have a system where, you know, the cultural assumption is the free and independent individual, it tends not to be an authority driven intellectual system. And that opens them up to all sorts of new ideas and new observations, and not just, you know, oh, here's this book that has been handed down to us, and the scholars at the university say this is the book where all the answers are, right? It encourages people to look outside and look at observation of the world for the answers. I also think there might be in there, you know, that when you have a society of small landowners who are used to running their own affairs, that habit of mind, you know, spills over to they get used to thinking for themselves. The second thing I would throw in very quickly is, because this fills in a gap from earlier, is when they have this system where they're starting to sort of claw back their rights from the rulers, they do it through a series of treaties and written laws like the Magna Carta. And then it's also worked out through the court system, through the common law. And I think that system of the common law and of the judges who are basically sitting there reasoning through who's right, who has what rights in these situations as applied to this particular case, that reliance on the common law as the main area in which a lot of these political and social questions are worked out, that may have contributed to this idea of this habit of reasoning in the legal way that you do when you're in a court dealing with a specific case. You're reasoning in terms of particulars, right? Each things aren't moved forward on, oh, I have a new theory. They're moved forward on, I have a new case with its specific concrete conditions that are present in that case. I have to go gather these facts. And on that basis, we mold the common law. I suspect, like I said, this is just a theory, but I suspect that had something to do with the creation of this sort of English, the good kind of English empiricism.
I just wanted to, I endorse that, Rob. I love that. The idea of the common law as an empirical, inductive approach to law. It's not enough, of course. You need top-down, so to speak, constitutional law, but was so, so important. Anchored in the facts, anchored in the day-to-day activities of people coming out of. Now, today, of course, people will say you can't have judge-made law. It really wasn't judge-made law. It just was case after case after case and precedent and what are we seeing here? And the whole tradition of British common law is amazing, remarkably amazing. I just wanted to put in a pitch for someone who's usually in the liberal community denounced as not one of ours. But David, I think the Hobbes, Thomas Hobbes, also a Brit, about 50 years before Locke, wrote Leviathan. And today Leviathan, of course, is synonymous with big government. But what was so interesting about Hobbes and his influence, Hobbes basically said, get religion out of politics. He was reacting to the religious civil wars in Britain in the 1640s between the Protestants and the Catholics. And if you read Hobbes closely, he basically said, government should be sovereign. It should put down these irrational civil wars, but for the purpose of giving people security and for the purpose of giving them predictable law. So he was like anti-anarchy, but because of the times had to be somewhat leaning toward the direction of heavy-handed government. So one thing he differed from Locke on was didn't think you could revolt against government. Whereas Locke said, no, you have a right to revolt if the government starts violating individual rights. The other thing very important, David, I think about Hobbes is he was the first what they call social contract theorist. So Hobbes came up with the idea. He said, if we have commercial contract, which is wonderful, mutual advantage, mutual benefit. This was, of course, coming out of the Renaissance and elsewhere. He said, I wonder if we can do the same thing politically. In other words, up until now, all governments had been established by force, by conquest, by arbitrary lineage of bloodlines. And, you know, his view was, I wonder if we can surmise and hypothesize about men getting together and creating a government out of, you know, nothing. And of course, Rousseau and Locke and others built upon this. But I think this contributed to the only great experiment ever done in this regard at Philadelphia. Philadelphia in 1787, to my mind, is the only example of a social contract hammered out by, 59 people? And Hamilton in Federalist 1 said, our goal here is to break the mold of history, because history up to now has been government by conquest and accident. And we're going to do it by reflection and reason and choice. And I think Hobbes was the fuel for that. But it's not quite the epistemological answer, I think, David, you were looking for. But I think if a country is providing liberty and is opposed to, you know, mixing mysticism and state, this was what Hobbes and Locke and others were doing. Maybe at least it gives greater scope for coming up with a reasoned governance.
Okay, thanks to both of you. I still have I can totally understand, given what you both have said, why the Brits and then Americans would have, leaned toward and a much more individualist view of politics, and I think underlying it ethics as well. What still puzzles me, though, is that the Enlightenment spread across all of Europe. Copernicus, who I think was Polish, and Leibniz and Descartes in France, and yet it was Newton who created the foundations of modern physics. Other thinkers who were the forefronts of science, from Boyle and many other people, at the forefronts. They were just way in advance they were there first. And it's still interesting to me that the English, despite the widespread European influence of Enlightenment ideas and the rebirth of reason, diminishing of faith as a source of knowledge, the English should have stood out so spectacularly and been to the point where they were the generators of the Industrial Revolution. So yeah, I think it's a mix of political issues, but also of I just sense there's something deeper. And I don't know the answer, but
I'm not sure I do.
I'll leave it there.
I'm not sure I do either, David, but it strikes me, you know, if you think of the science of physics, Newton, the science of politics, Locke, the science of economics, Smith, amazing, all from Britain. Amazing.
I have thoughts on this, but I think it's maybe getting too much into the weeds and we should go on to other questions.
All right, good, good. Other questions?
Great. Thank you. Roger, thank you for your patience.
Hey, what's up? Just wanted to say hi to Jag real quick. And also wanted to thank Richard. The debates that you're engaging in with ANCAPs is close to my heart. I'm a capitalist and for limited government. And so a lot of the points you make, I like. But in regards to this room,
thank you, Roger.
You got it. And I'm going to have to listen back to the replay of this to get some of the reading recommendations that were made earlier. I'm fairly well read on, Mill and Locke and others like Burke. But you guys mentioned some that are outside of my wheelhouse. So I appreciate that. My question here is around it seems like when it comes to British imperialism, there's a utilitarian argument that supports why it was such a good idea. I've heard people in India make the argument that without British imperialism, we wouldn't have had science and medicine and law, and actually very thankful for what the British brought them. But from a libertarian perspective, which is, something that I tend to steer towards, I think the good ideas don't require force. And so I guess my question is, moving forward, as we're now the liberty-minded people, the people that believe in individual rights and free markets, whether you're, an objectivist, some conservatives and certainly libertarians that are trying to orient the world back into this place where individual rights and free markets make sense. Do you guys point to any philosophers or authors today, aside from the scholars at the Atlas Society, who I would encourage everybody to follow? Is there anybody else that we're missing that we should be paying attention to?
Let me take some of that stuff about colonialism first, though. One thing I wanted to pick about the British Empire is it was not entirely maintained by force and brutality. Oftentimes it was, there was some battle and they conquered an area, but especially I think in India, one of the reasons why the British did well is that they provided, at the time, basically the Mughal Empire was collapsing and there was this, general warfare among all these little tiny little kingdoms, things like that. And they provided basically a leadership that had no tribe, that had no religion. They actually firmly discouraged, especially after the mutiny in the 1860s, they firmly discouraged Christian missionaries in India because they're like, no, don't set these people off. They're so suspicious that we're going to try to convert them away from Hinduism or from Islam. But they provided this sort of secular government and a common language. 500 languages in India to this day that Indians will still use English communicating with each other.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was a lot of advantages they brought that got a certain they earned them a certain amount of voluntary compliance. The empire offered a lot. In the same way, the Roman Empire spread so much because it offered a lot to the people in it. However, I also say one of the things that I didn't get to earlier is. One of the problems of colonialism in general, and most countries were worse than Britain in this regard, is that colonial rule was a place where you got to throw away all the rules that applied domestically, right? So in England, in Britain itself, if you're going to do something, you have to go to Parliament, you have to get all these people's approval, you have to convince people, and when you're off in the colonies. You don't have to have anybody vote. You can do whatever you like, And so there was this, it was the downside of colonialism for the colonial powers and for the people they ruled was that oftentimes the system of government there was less free and less progressive and less advanced than the one they had back home. And that was, of course, it's worse. Like one of the worst examples was I think it was in the Congo or somewhere like that, that it was basically, it was ruled as the personal property of the Belgian king. And he was just absolutely brutal, and there were no rules and no limits on his control at all. No limits on his power at all. And I think the Spanish were the same way. It was just totally feudal, the way that they created their empire in Latin America. So yeah, I agree. There's good sides to colonialism, but there's also some serious bad sides to it.
Yeah. I would just add quickly so we can get to other questions. When you consider the Roman Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the Soviet Empire, you can distinguish empires between, I think, nasty, vicious, versus benevolent. In the 1800s, 1700s, there were monarchs known as, and czars, known as enlightened monarchs, enlightened czars. I'm thinking of Catherine, others. Yeah. I would even, I think, include Nicholas. But anyway, the point is, America, this is a somewhat controversial statement, but I would say America owes its independence to a benevolent British empire. I mean, I don't really think the British had the heart to smite us. That we were too much like them. That they really let Washington off the hook. I mean, think of it. Not only in 1776 in the war, but 1812 when they burned down the White House. You have to thank the Brits for being so humanitarian, for being so civilized. And to this day, I cringe when I hear people denounce the British Empire. Because, yes, I agree with Rob. All the defects of, you know, capitalism is not imperialism. Capitalism is not mercantilism. It's not colonialism. But once you're in that realm and start distinguishing between, you know, monarchs that are constitutionally limited, empires that are fundamentally humane and are trying to spread civilization to the rest of the world, I think it made America possible, because they clearly could have beaten the hell out of us when we revolted. And they didn't. And they chose not to. I believe they chose not to. Anyway, more questions?
One other thing I was just tossing. Roger was asking for other people to read. I'd say Bacon.
That's a good one too. Yep.
So, you know, when Bacon, Locke, and Newton were considered the godfathers of the Enlightenment, that's another philosopher. Yep.
And an empiricist also. Yeah.
Great. Well, Michael's been waiting patiently, talking in the chat about engineering differences between England and the U.S. Michael?
Yeah, I totally agree with, and I'm not just being agreeable, thank you for hearing me here. And shout out to Duke. I do lecture over at Fuqua every once in a while. So shout out.
Oh, great. Thank you, Michael. Good, Michael.
And I'm a former athlete. But I spend about two weeks on, 2 weeks off over in the U.K. I employ people there. I lecture there. I do work with the auto manufacturers and a couple tech companies there. Stateside, I've done a lot of work here as well. The difference that I've seen as an employer and a person that is usually in new products, large products, Fortune 100 type stuff. And I just, if you PTR, I put it because someone said Sir Isaac Newton. A week and a half ago, I was at Cambridge and I got the grand tour of the engineering building and, you know, lectured in electrical engineering, bio stuff with the PhD students. Cambridge has $8 billion with a B dollar endowment. But how they're taking stuff to market and how they're partnering with corporations. And then you go look at the business stuff, which I was there for, not the Cambridge stuff. That was one day out of 2 weeks. There's people coasting and rest and, you know, people who are given their nom stories and they're getting a little bit old. What you see is a service-based economy. And when Russia or whoever is pulling their money out of the banks and they're all bankers that are paid way more than they would get paid here in the States, the money's going down. The other stuff's going down, but they're not exporting anything. They're not manufacturing anything. And there's a lot of stuff that you see as a unifying theme when you're in there to work with actual Fortune 100 businesses. There's too much bureaucracy, too much policy, and the people that want to think are too beaten down. So whatever you think is going on here that you're not allowed to speak up at work or whatever, it's over there. It's the rules won't let us. And it's very noticeable. And you could see it in the airport. You could see it at Starbucks. You could see it at, you know, major university, everything in there. And then the classism stuff, you have people, you know, you go to the to Bond Street or you go to any of the big streets, big shops, the Park Avenue, the Rodeo Drive equivalents, and you see rich people who aren't from there. They just happen to be there because it's where business is done. It's a capital. But people are worshiping the richest people there and then pretending to be the upper class, the royals. And they have that stuff, but that classism, when you introduce yourself to somebody, it's pretty much, are you a descendant of a king or a royal? And they try to classify you like a bug. You contrast that to tech. I was a microchip engineer at Intel. I've launched a lot of stuff when I was younger. Now I'm old. But you hear over here, it's, tell me about yourself. Tell me about the merit of what you do, what you've done, who you've worked with, how you help move a team. The attitude is different. And I would say what once was great and was the foundation of stuff, and we stand on their shoulders, it's really slowing down because they had the first industrial revolution, but we've had tech, and tech's changed the world. And right now, there's a lot of stuff. And when you say read a book, maybe you read a Ray Dalio book. Maybe you read a Steve Jobs book. Maybe you read something about people here that have been innovating and making the 5-10 biggest companies in the world. And you see that people up in Manchester are studying a lot of stuff from U.S. schools. They're sending their innovation people over here. So we do stand on their shoulders. I think we have a lot in common. They're foundational to all this stuff. But I think what made them not so great is looking backwards, telling the NOM stories, and then just, you know, being all service and some of the other stuff. There's so many rules and policies that prevent them. Even to start a business there, you have to get blessed by the damn queen, who's no, sorry, shouldn't say that. She passed.
You want to give them a chance to answer? Or?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think we should. Michael, great points. And yeah, I mean, there is a story of high tech in Ireland, which is wonderful. But no, yeah, you're right.
1,000%.
I'm not sure any of the revival of Britain would have been possible without the Thatcher Revolution. So maybe I think in both countries, maybe what would we can contribute more than anything is stop feeling guilty for your past successes. I'm addressing both America and Britain. You know, don't let people denigrate your history. These are two close cousins who brought liberty and sanity and industriousness and prosperity to the world. And they've gone off the rails since, but it can be revived. It's been shown to have been revived in the 80s and 90s, and we need to do even better going forward. But good points, Michael. Other questions?
One thing I would throw in on that, by the way, is that the stories from like the 18th and 19th century, there's a tremendous number of sort of rags to riches stories of people who came from nowhere in Britain and, you know, no background.
Oh, yeah.
Remember one story, I can't remember the guy's name, but he was like a shepherd, this, you know, dirt poor shepherd who sent his son off to school, like walking 3 miles a day to school to learn how to read. And every day when his son came home, he would have his son teach him how to read. And both father and son went on to become engineers and like build these bridges across Scotland and all over Scotland during the Industrial Revolution. This tremendous rags to riches story. So there was this tremendous dynamism. And one of the roles that the British Empire played in that society was it was their Wild West. It was where you could go off. You were nobody from no money. You could go off.
Good. Yeah, I like that.
South Africa. So, you know, there was this tremendous dynamism into that society that I think got, you know, as progressive as socialism is, it actually creates a more stagnant society where class and wealth and who was your father, that actually ends up mattering more.
I like that, Rob. And, you know, Carnegie, Scotland, Arkwright, Watt, there are also stories of Luddites trashing their operations, burning down their factories, very heroic story where they persisted I'm going to do this anyway, even though I'm facing. And, you know, even when Britain goes somewhere and believes in private property and believes in commerce and stuff and are met with tribalists or are met with nomads, nomads who do not actually believe in property rights, but later say to themselves, hey, you robbed us of our property, which we never claimed to own in the first place. So a lot of that kind of anachronistic stuff is going on. There were no property rights among Indians in America, Native Americans. They didn't believe in property rights. Now, that doesn't mean they should be slaughtered, but the idea of extending the Lockean notion of property rights and actually practicing it in America, you really are not in a position of saying you stole my property when you don't believe in property. You're a nomad and you don't believe in settling and you're a hunter-gatherer group. But you know, hard to say today. You get vilified for saying such things today. Other questions?
Yeah, let's go to Morgan. Morgan, thank you for waiting.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity. I have a question. It's, I think, a very basic question, and it's more a matter of curiosity in my case. I'm afraid I got into this conversation about only just about 10 to 15 minutes ago, and so I did hear the mentions of Isaac Newton and John Locke in terms of the advancement of science and politics. And hearing their names kind of has made me wonder if there was perhaps a particular era or a particular century in the history of Britain where you could actually point to it and say that was when Britain began to become a great nation. If that is so, can you tell me what you think that era was or what that century was when it began?
Well, I would, if I would quickly... thank you, Morgan. I would pick, it's not really a particular center, I would pick something like 1650 to 1750, because that century includes Hobbes, but goes up roughly to Adam Smith. But in between, my gosh, Hobbes, Newton, Bacon, Locke, Smith, it's just a who's who of the great minds of every field. Rob, do you have a different answer? I would pick 1650 to 1750. Or 1776, roughly.
The Spanish Armada.
Okay.
No, that's right. The point at which Britain emerged as, like, you know, the great Spanish army.
Yeah.
You know, the great power filled with all this wealth from the New World, and they went to conquer. Yeah. And a bunch of guys in little ships basically just destroy their entire fleet.
Yeah.
It comes also at a time when, you know, you have Shakespeare and not.
Oh, London. Yeah. Yeah. Elizabethan. Oh, yeah.
So basically, that's the point at which
I know.
England emerges as a great culture, as a great cultural power and a great military power and a great political power.
Yeah.
But it becomes the balance of power in Europe through a lot of things that happen after that. So I'd say that's where it emerges into greatness.
Yeah, and another way of looking at this is we just celebrated, Columbus Day. Here's an Italian, thank you, Columbus. But really what settled and made America great was Britain. So thank you, Britain. Before, I know we only have 6 minutes or so, I want to take another question. But I just wanted to say something quickly, especially for objectivists. It is who wonder about the future and what's possible and the march of democracy. And it is interesting to me that the great revolutions, the great political revolutions that actually led to good results were aristocratic. They were top down. And the worst ones, the worst of all, were bottom up. So by top down, I think of something like the aristocracy revolting against King John. Then the Magna Carta, stop taxing us, stop treating us arbitrarily. 1776, those were elites. Jefferson, Hamilton, Adams, they were elites. The elites who had the arguments, who had the power, and they're the ones who fought against tyranny. Now, the bottom up, I would pick France, Russia, Cuba. When you get proles, proletariat, peasants, idiots, a passion driven, emotion driven, no real arguments, just anger, just viciousness.
It doesn't do very well. So I throw that out there because I think Britain
too much philosophy. There are too many philosophers involved.
Yeah. Okay. Scott, do we have time for more?
Yeah, we should have time for another question. John?
Thank you. Another excellent program, guys.
Thanks, John.
And by the way, Robert, you mentioned in my lineage is Scotch-Irish engineers who went to South Africa and built the Trans-African Railway and the great ports there, the breakaway. So the history of engineering in the British Empire and the Wild West, it's a good point. The other thing I think is on the decolonialization, we touched upon that. And I think that the socialist zeitgeist that was in control mid-20th century and after World War II that resulted in decolonialization set hundreds of countries off on the wrong course. The leadership of those new countries was educated in Britain or the United States. They were taught basically a socialist ethic. They went back to their countries educated with that ethic. And then we had 40, 50 years of a mess. And I'll shut up now.
Well, one thing I would throw in there is, the problem, I mentioned that a lot of the colonization done by Britain was done in response to other colonial powers. Like, we got to do this so that the French don't take over, or so that the Spanish don't take over, et cetera. And the mistake of decolonization is you got rid of one imperial power and just made room for another, because the Soviets said, oh, we don't have qualms about colonialism. We'll come in and we'll install a regime that we like. And so one of the things that happened is you had, and it's not just because they were educated in British universities, it's you also had the Soviets seeing that as a land of opportunity, that every little anti-colonial movement we're going to support, and then when they come into power, we're going to have them impose communism, and that's how we're going to take over Africa and Latin America and all these places. And that, you know, the retreat of the colonial powers was seen as an opportunity for a new, you know, Russian imperialism under the Soviet banner.
I would just add, this is David, that in the Middle East and the Islamic world, with even the liberators, the so-called Enlightenment people, imported the worst European and American ideas from their culture. And that's a big source of the problems in the Middle East today.
Yeah, I think the Ba'ath Party, Saddam Hussein's party in Iraq, was formed by a guy who was educated at the Sorbonne in Paris and brought in these, you know, Parisian, basically fascist ideas from the early 20th century, brought them back to the police.
It's also struck me over the years looking at post-colonial periods that those who in Africa and elsewhere who say we haven't developed because the British oppressed us for so long and coerced us for so long and exploited us for so long, these are exactly the policies that are used locally. I mean, the ANC in South Africa, the African National Congress, they're Marxist. They've been exploiting and stealing and destroying. So there's a hypocrisy there which has to be exposed. But to remain on the positive, I think it's undeniable that the British Empire has done great things over the history for these foreign peoples. We have maybe 1 minute, Scott.
Well, we're about at time. This has been an amazing topic. A lot of great engagement. Just real briefly, tomorrow at 5 p.m. Eastern, the Atlas Society Asks will host JAG interviewing Dr. Hooman Hemmadi, a longtime critic of COVID-19 lockdowns. Then at 7 p.m. Eastern tomorrow, Professor Stephen Hicks will continue his series on education's heroes and villains, this one on Dewey and pragmatic democracy. I think that's a villain. Also, if you're going to be in Miami this weekend, the Atlas Society will be at LibertyCon. Rob and Patrick Reasonover will be giving presentations. We have a booth, so if you're there, come by and say hello. Thanks again to you both for doing this, everyone that asked questions, and we look forward to seeing you on the next one.
Scott, Rob, thank you very much. Thanks all for joining. Thank you, David.
Thanks, everyone. Jim.